Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Biden's strategy to combat violent crime and guns, announced today after meeting in the White House with big city mayors alarmed at the 33% rise in homicides, who are calling for community support for crime prevention. Philip Stinson, a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University and the author of Police Crime, The Criminal Behavior of Sworn Law Enforcement Officers, joins us to discuss how Biden is trying to get out ahead of the Republican plan to demagogue crime as an election issue and paint the Democrats as soft on crime, tying Biden to calls to defund the police. Given the early results in the New York City mayoral elections, in which a former NYPD officer is running ahead of a police watchdog in a very liberal city, it is clear that law and order is a potent political issue and that reform efforts after the George Floyd murder have stalled. Then we look into the tense situation in Peru, where the loser in the recent election is following Trump's playbook, claiming the election was stolen while searching for votes to overturn the results. Joe Marie Burt, a senior fellow at the Washington Office for Latin America and a professor of political science and Latin America at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University and author of Silencing Civil Society, Political Violence, and the Authoritarian State of Peru, joins us. We will discuss how the former dictator's daughter, who is facing jail for corruption, has the backing of big business and the Fox News-like media monopoly, who are painting the winner as a dangerous Marxist about to turn Peru into Venezuela. Then finally, with Dr. Fauci warning that 20% of all new cases of COVID are the virulent Delta variant that will soon be dominant in a matter of weeks, the need for more vaccinations is critical, but up to 1/4 of the American population, according to an NPR Marist poll, say they would decline to get vaccinated even when offered. Seth Mnookin, the director of MIT's graduate program in science writing and author of The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy, joins us to discuss how the anti-science movement in this country threatens us all. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Philip Stinson, who's a professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Stinson's research interests include police crime, police integrity, quantitative content analyses, program evaluation, and unmet mental health and special education needs. And he's the author of Police Crime, The Criminal Behavior of Sworn Law Enforcement Officers, published in Sociology Compass. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Stinson.
It's good to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And President Biden had a very delayed press conference today announcing Biden's strategy to combat violent crime with a focus on guns and community support. He had the Attorney General beside him. They're going to work together. A lot of executive orders will be issued in terms of getting rid of ghost guns and trying to get background checks and stuff that have obviously always been stalled in terms of gun safety. But the context, of course, Phil, is the 33% increase in homicides last year in major American cities. And I'm sure that what's the subtext of all of this is that Biden is trying to burnish his law and order qualifications because the Republicans are going to seize on law and order in the upcoming election year. What's your sense?
Well, I think that's true. I think Biden's in a difficult situation here. There's a lot of legislation that's been stalled that I think he thought would be much easier to get through. So, for example, the what they've called the George Floyd Act, the federal efforts at police reform, all of that's stalled. I think a lot of times when I look at federal legislation, you know, a lot of my focus is on police misconduct and behaviors of police officers. But more generally with crime, and when we have spikes in crimes, I think that last year the increase in different types of crime in many parts of the country, we really don't have a handle on that yet as to what's going on there, whether there's a trend, whether we're reversing trends where we'd seen crime go down and now going back up. On the other hand, does the pandemic have a lot to do with it, and that everybody was really out of sorts last year? Their normal routines were interrupted. And I think it's going to be several years before, as a criminologist, we really have a handle on that type of thing. So one of the things that I always wonder about, though, is whether, you know, we have a lot of symbolic political crime control rhetoric. In other words, there's a problem that's been identified. Let's do something about it, and let's do something about it because we have to do something about it. Now, many of the things that the president dealt with today are things that needed to be dealt with, that we've heard about before, as you've pointed out. But I think that to a great extent, what we're dealing with is doing something because something needs to be done.
Well, one of the things that Biden stressed in terms of gun control initiatives, or gun safety initiatives, I think is the term they prefer to use nowadays, kept saying that hunters and gun owners are with him. I don't know whether they are or not. I know the NRA has imploded because of its own corruption. But he did say you need background checks for purchasing a firearm. That's important. And he needed a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, just quoting from the president. No one needs to have a weapon that can fire over 30, 40, 50, even up to 100 rounds, unless you think the deers are wearing Kevlar vests or something. So I don't know. Do you think that's working? Does he really have gun owners and hunters on his side?
No, I don't think so. I think we're in polarized times, and I think that he probably doesn't. You know, these really are strange times. There's an opinion that came out from the Ohio Supreme Court just a few hours ago in a case that has to do with whether school teachers should be required to have training before they can carry guns in K-12 schools in the state of Ohio. And the Supreme Court of Ohio said they did. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of interesting things in terms of gun control and laws that deal with firearms. But no, I think the president, though, is looking forward to the midterm elections and wanting to make sure that he holds on to the House, and that perhaps gains a seat or two in the Senate would be ideal from his perspective. And I think a lot of this is really staging for 2022.
Well, it is an extraordinary time in terms of we've seen the embarrassingly impotent results of gun control over the years. And when we do have progress like an assault weapons ban, it sunsets. And here in California, there's an assault weapons ban, and just one federal judge recently overturned it. But fortunately, the Ninth Circuit reversed this judge. And this judge argument was that you don't need an assault weapons ban because AR-15 assault rifles are no different from a Swiss Army knife. So there's a strange kind of pro-gun culture out there that sees no limits to the amount of firepower that can be on the streets of America. So, you know, I'm not sure that this is a particularly useful conversation. We've had it so many times. I just don't know that it's going anywhere.
I don't think it is. And it's interesting, you know, in my work, we've looked a lot at the militarization of police departments, of state and local law enforcement agencies, frankly, since the Vietnam War, that era, the early 1970s. And I think with gun owners, a lot of this with the assault rifles, it's the militarization of gun ownership. It's really not about firearms to protect yourself, but we're talking about guns that in my view, nobody should have to have a need for something like an AR-15. So I had not heard that the Ninth Circuit overturned that judge. I'm glad to hear that.
And again, I'm speaking with Philip Stinson, who's a professor in the Criminal Justice Program at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Stinson's research interests include police crime, police integrity, quantitative content analyses, program evaluation, and unmet mental health and special education needs. And he's the author of Police Crime, The Criminal Behavior of Sworn Law Enforcement Officers, published in Sociology Compass. So I think in a way, Phil, and I mean, I don't know that this is necessarily what Biden was trying to get ahead of, to burnish his law and order credentials with this speech today, because obviously he's quite preoccupied with yesterday's disastrous setback in terms of stopping the steal underway for the next elections by the GOP, who are resorting to an extraordinary number of voter suppression measures, and of course the infrastructure deal. But I guess this was scheduled. But it coincides, of course, with yesterday's elections in New York, which is a completely Democratic city. Whoever wins the New York Democratic primary becomes the mayor. And in this case, a former police officer, a former NYPD police officer, African-American, and a former Republican, as a matter of fact, won or is winning against a police watchdog, Maya Wiley. So is that some kind of signal that maybe is out there that the White House is concerned about, that people want law and order, even in an incredibly liberal city? And, you know, the last thing that's working for Democrats is defund the police.
Well, defund the police means different things to different people. I have colleagues who take that very literally, and they mean every bit of it, that they want to defund the police. Certainly, a more tempered view is to really think about the functions, responsibilities of state and local law enforcement agencies and what resources they have, and whether some of those responsibilities, functions, and resources should be transferred to other human services, other social service agencies. So, you know, it used to be, up until about 5-6 years ago, if you would talk to a police chief in any community across the country, they would be in favor. They would give you a list of things that they'd like to get rid of in terms of responsibilities, things that their agencies have to deal with, things that over time sort of fell on the police that weren't traditional police functions. So, for example, with the deinstitutionalization of the mental health system, and then with the really sort of crises with local mental health providers, public mental health providers having funding crises in recent years, more and more has fallen on law enforcement agencies, whether it's police departments or sheriff's offices. And they would tell you the things that they would like to get rid of. But now that this has become so politicized, in terms of defund the police, they really sort of seem to be digging in and not wanting any part of it. So a lot of this really is politicized.
Well, there have been, you know, a sort of police strike in Portland and other places where the police feel that their morale is low, et cetera, and that they've been beaten up ever since the George Floyd situation. But the problem is that have the lessons been learned? I mean, are we recruiting better people, or are we recruiting these kind of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who think the streets of America are no different from the streets of Baghdad, and look upon the local inhabitants as the enemy?
Well, that's true. We have a situation where we have police officers working in quasi-military organizations, wearing quasi-military-style uniforms, who are sent out every day as warriors to fight crime, fight the war on drugs, fight something. And warriors need an enemy. So as long as we have that type of situation, one of the things that I worry about is that so many police officers exhibit a fear of black people, a fear of black men, black boys, black women, and black girls. And until we deal with some of the issues, some of the core values of the police subculture that we see in many of the more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country, until we deal with those things, I really don't think we're going to be able to make meaningful reforms in terms of changing police practices.
Well, just in closing, I mean, the problem is that the whole debate after George Floyd has shifted away from social justice and racial justice to blaming Black Lives Matter, and now you've got this ridiculous idea of schools teaching critical race theory, which they don't do in the first place, which is an attempt to take away the narrative of the need to understand the history of injustice against African Americans and how it has to be redressed.
Well, I think if anything, the Trump years gave us the opportunity to really see that this country is very divided and that there is a lot of racism in all corners of the country.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Philip Stinson.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Stinson, who's a professor in the Criminal Justice Program at Bowling Green State University. Dr. Stinson's research interests include police crime, police integrity, quantitative content analyses, program evaluation, and unmet mental health and special education needs. And he's the author of Police Crime, The Criminal Behavior of Sworn Law Enforcement Officers, published in Sociology Compass. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the tense situation in Peru, where the loser of the recent election is following Trump's playbook, claiming the election was stolen while searching for votes to overturn the results. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jo Marie Burt, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office for Latin America and a professor of political science and Latin American studies at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, who has published widely on political violence, state-society relations, human rights, and transnational justice in Latin America. A research consultant for Open Society's Justice Initiative. She writes about war crimes prosecutions in Guatemala for International Justice Monitor and is the author of Silencing Civil Society, Political Violence and the Authoritarian State in Peru. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jo Marie Burt.
Hi, Ian. It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you did a lot of work during the period of the Fujimori regime, the dictatorship of Fujimori, whose daughter is now contesting the recent election in Peru. And you were there for the human rights trials of him in 2009, and you organized international observation missions to those trials. And you were also, from 2002 to 2003, a member of the regional studies research team of the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And you were a Fulbright scholar in Peru at the Pontifical Catholic University of Peru. So you clearly have a long association with that country. And what do you make of what's happening now, where the Fujimori daughter who lost the election is now sending teams of lawyers out into the country to literally disappear votes and essentially conduct a coup? She's already got the retired military people supporting her and sending a letter to the military saying that you can't support the leftist candidate. So it's very much like the Donald Trump situation, where he said, just find me 11,000 votes. In this case, she's basically saying, find me 44,000 votes, which is the margin she lost by.
Correct. Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that this is Keiko Fujimori's third attempt to be elected president. She lost in 2011 to a leftist populist former military official by a very wide margin. She immediately recognized her defeat. In 2016, she lost to another right-wing candidate, Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, by a mere 41,000 votes, which is important to see how this narrow vote is not unprecedented at all. And, you know, it took her several days. She did not actually acknowledge her defeat. She, quote-unquote, accepted the results, right? But she then had a supermajority in Congress and pursued a very obstructionist platform. In fact, within 2 years, Peru had four different presidents, largely driven by Keiko Fujimori's obstructionism. So this time around, this was her third push for the presidency. Not only is she interested in running the country and all that comes with it, but she also has a very real need to become president to avoid prison. She faces a 31-year potential prison sentence if she is prosecuted and convicted on charges of money laundering, leading a criminal organization, and obstruction of justice. These are real charges. She's already been indicted. She was in preventive detention and was only released because of the COVID pandemic, which is a very odd thing, right? So she has quite a bit at stake. And there's sort of this intersection of interests, right, between elites and others who believe very strongly in the sort of the reigning neoliberal free market economic model that Keiko Fujimori's father implanted and that she is a huge champion of, given the fact that her opponent is, you know, a leftist who has promised sweeping political and economic changes. So there's a lot at stake for those who follow Keiko Fujimori, those who follow the sort of right-wing free market platform. So that's a beginning foray into the situation in Peru. But I think to understand, it's been more than 15 days since the election happened. So it's very odd that the elections authorities have not declared a winner, right? Even though the original ballot counting ended over a week ago, almost 10 days now, and Castillo was deemed, you know, the winner by 44,000 votes. But Keiko Fujimori has presented, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of claims of fraud, which the elections authority are diligently, patiently, carefully reviewing, and they have virtually discarded each and every one because they're spurious. They're based on, you know, nothing. There is really no evidence of fraud. So what you have is very much like what we experienced here in the U.S. in 2020, baseless claims of elections fraud, which is echoed by certain media. So followers of Keiko Fujimori are convinced that there was fraud and are willing to defend, you know, quote unquote, their vote. Whereas the evidence is such that, you know, there's no real proof of fraud. There were international elections observers, several organizations in Peru, including the Human Rights Ombudsman's Office, International Transparency, that also observed the election, and the result is resoundingly the same. These were clean, fair, impartial, and peaceful elections, right? And you know, you may have seen yesterday the United States Department of State also issued a very short but potent statement acknowledging also that the elections were free and fair, and saying that they are looking forward to working with the next president of Peru once the elections authorities finalize this process of reviewing the votes and so forth. But I mean, the other thing that's important to keep in mind is because the vote is so narrow and the tensions are so high, I think it is important to give the election authorities the space and time they need to complete the count. And I think we'll see in a few days, I'm hopeful that we'll see in a few days, the elections authorities coming around to announcing Pedro Castillo as the winner. But as you noted, there are countervailing forces that are pressuring, not just pushing forward the narrative of fraud, but perpetuating some of the arguments that Keiko Fujimori put forth during the campaign, which is that Pedro Castillo is a dangerous subversive, a communist, and he will likely bring Peru either to become a new Venezuela, which, you know, as we may know, is a country in deep, deep crisis, or will return Peru to the political violence of the 1980s, yet both of which are, you know, kind of ludicrous. They're not based in any real reality. But these are fears that, you know, the upper, middle and upper classes have sort of latched onto, and that the military, a retired military, it's important to say, because the institutional Peruvian military remains loyal to the Constitution. There have been at least three public statements put out by the Ministry of Defense reaffirming the Peruvian military's commitment to the rule of law, to the Constitution, dismissing efforts by retired military officials to lobby for military intervention. And it is very important to highlight that many of those military officials were active duty, either soldiers or mid-ranking or even senior officials during the regime of Keiko Fujimori's father, which was essentially he was elected into office, but very quickly devolved into an authoritarian government with the backing of the army. And he basically used the armed forces as his political party, since he did not himself have a political party. And he was very much an independent, not connected to existing parties at the time. He allied himself with the Peruvian armed forces. And during the 10 years of his government, with the backing of the Peruvian military, corruption became absolutely rampant. Human rights abuses also rampant. And at the end of his regime, when Fujimori fled the country in disgrace, he left, you know, presumably for a conference somewhere in Asia, and he ended up going to Japan, the homeland of his parents, and resigned by fax. After that, the Peruvian military had to take a cold, hard look at itself, and they actually had to apologize to the Peruvian people for aligning themselves with such a corrupt administration and for allowing themselves to be manipulated and used politically by the Fujimori government. So, you know, there's, I think there are many members, especially retired members of the armed forces, who maybe look, you know, nostalgically upon the Fujimori era. But I think there are also others who are true institutionalists who do not want to go down that road and realize the peril, not just for Peru's democracy, but also for the military itself, right? So there's a lot of history in what's happening right now in Peru.
And again, I'm speaking with Joan Marie Burt, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America and a professor of political science and Latin American studies at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. She is a research consultant for the Open Society Justice Initiative, and she's the author of Silencing Civil Society, Political Violence and the Authoritarian State in Peru. So you've made it clear, Joan Marie, that the analogies with Trump are extraordinary. Not only do you have the analogy of find me the 11,000 votes, she wants 44,000. Trump, of course, is motivated to stay in office because he's afraid of going to jail, as is Netanyahu. But the idea, after you've just explained to us what her father did to the country, the idea that she could even be a power in the Congress and have done this well in the elections, even though she lost by 44,000 votes. I mean, this would be like Ivanka Trump running today, right? It's just extraordinary that she's gotten this far. And I take it the reason that she got this far in the election is because the Peruvian establishment, the business community, and the media, which is sort of Fox-like, run by Murdoch-type oligarchs, have been pushing this line heavily that Castillo will turn the country into a Venezuela, right?
That is correct. The role of the media has been really important here. During the 90s, I lived in Peru for several years during the 1990s when her father was president, and I had lived in Peru in the 80s. So I remember very clearly the deterioration of the Peruvian media, particularly open source television. There was not even yet cable TV until the very end of the 90s in Peru. So it was all open source television. And the electronic media essentially over time had been completely and 100% co-opted by the Fujimori government. In fact, at the end of his regime, there were a series of videos that were released showing his top security advisor, Vladimiro Montesinos, former military official, bribing official after official, military officials, media executives, opposition politicians, so on and so forth. And among those he bribed were media executives. And the whole idea was to create a, so it's like as if every single open TV channel was Fox News, only repeating the Fox News line. So what's happened in this campaign, which it's extraordinary because that was when Fujimori was the dictator. Today, there's a democracy in Peru. Keiko Fujimori is not in power, and yet the media, sort of its own accord, has almost slovenly given itself over to Keiko Fujimori, bought hook, line, and sinker this idea that Castillo is a radical who will plunge Peru into the dark ages or something. And they're basically doing Keiko Fujimori's propaganda work for free. It's really extraordinary. And it's only thanks to the fact that in this age of the internet, there is a wide variety of independent media accessible through the internet. And then there's a whole radio community, radio and so forth, that people can actually get independent news in Peru. It's really quite extraordinary. Just to give you an example, on Saturday or Sunday, there were parallel rallies going on in Lima. One with Pedro Castillo, the Keiko Fujimori's opponent, was not actually there, but it was his supporters, his followers, some politicians who were backing him. And it was massive. It was festive. And the other side of town, Keiko Fujimori with her supporters, kind of a stop the steal rally vibe. The open TV channels literally stopped their coverage, whatever shows were going on. They stopped what was going on and they started covering Keiko Fujimori's protest or public, you know, public meeting, and completely ignored or gave a tiny moment to Pedro Castillo's meeting. And really only talked about what Keiko's message was, which was that these elections were stolen from us and that we're going to fight till the very end to make sure that the people's will, quote unquote, is being upheld. So it is, like you're saying, a Murdoch-type oligarchs. I mean, literally one economic group, the El Comercio group, controls 80% of the Peruvian media. So it's a deeply problematic. I think it really is a lesson about how important media is to democracy, and when it is concentrated the way it is in Peru, it can help undermine and maybe even subvert democracy.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Jeremy, but if they make a move against Castillo and pressure the Electoral Commission to overturn the victory, which is presumably what they're doing, and even though you mentioned that the U.S. State Department has made it clear that they thought this was a clean and fair election, Castillo's party only has, 37 seats in the 130-seat parliament, which
Correct.
Is Congress, which is largely dominated by Fujimori, which is in itself a bit of a mystery. He doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver as a leader, does he?
And this is one of the things that I think is really important to think about. You know, there's all this talk about he will bring, you know, he'll turn Peru into Venezuela, he'll turn Peru into this, he'll turn Peru into that. Well, he is going to be an extremely weak leader, in fact, precisely for the reasons that you're pointing to. And the other part, there are three right-wing parties that competed in the first round that have together a majority in Congress. So there's likely to be a great deal of obstructionism in this new Congress. And so I don't think that Castillo is going to have a great deal of luck at all pushing forth a radical agenda. On the contrary, he's going to have to moderate and build coalitions in order to get anything done. So my biggest fear actually is not, you know, Venezuela or some, you know, somehow some magical turn to communism. It's rather ungovernability and political instability, which is what we saw in Peru for the last 5 years. And I think this is really important. In 2020, Keiko Fujimori's party, in alliance with several other conservative parties, spent a great deal of energy in the middle of the pandemic to remove the sitting president, Martin Vizcarra, who had become president after they had removed the previously elected president, and the man who defeated Keiko Fujimori in 2016. They did this in the middle of the pandemic, and I think it's no surprise that Peru is one of the countries in the world with the highest fatality rates in the world. Because politicians, rather than trying to address this grave public health crisis, are vying for power, and they're playing obstructionist games rather than trying to find real solutions for everyday Peruvians. And I'm afraid we're going to see more of this in the coming years. That's my biggest fear for Peru in the years ahead.
Well, Jeremy Bird, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Well, I wish it was a more optimistic scenario, but you clearly know the country, and I appreciate what you've told us, as depressing as it is.
Well, thanks. I'm a little more, after the State Department, to be honest with you, after the State Department statement, I'm a little more optimistic. I think that there is, while the pressures are very intense to overturn these results, I think there is some resilience that I'm seeing, and I'm very hopeful that, you know, but we're going to see a deeply polarized and unstable place. So it is not, even if the election results are upheld, I still think we're going to see a very unstable, unhappy outcome, unfortunately. Unless she goes to jail, which is another option, right? She faces real, you know, if she's not president, she faces a real, you know.
We all live in hope that she will go to jail, that Trump will go to jail, that Netanyahu will go to jail, you name it. But I thank you again, and I've been speaking with Jeremy Burt, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America and a professor of political science and Latin American studies at the Shah School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. She's also a research consultant for the Open Society Justice Initiative and the author of Silencing Civil Society, Political Violence and the Authoritarian State in Peru. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Dr. Fauci's warning today that 20% of all new cases of COVID are the virulent Delta variant that will soon be dominant in a matter of weeks.
I don't need no doctor, 'cause I know what's in me. I don't need no doctor, no, no.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Seth Mnookin, who's the director of MIT's graduate program in science writing. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Feeding the Monster, How Money, Smarts, and Nerve Took a Team to the Top, Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. And his latest book is The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Seth Mnookin.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And yesterday in the White House, President Biden made a plea for people to get vaccinated and do it right away. And today, Dr. Fauci said that the Delta variant of the coronavirus accounts for 20% of the new cases in this country, that it's exploded in the UK and around the world, and that he's extremely worried about it. So we have this odd situation in this country where the evidence should be really clear that we had, 3,000 deaths a day in January, and now we're down to a little over 300. But as Dr. Fauci warns, it's going to get worse. And yet something like 40% of the country doesn't want to get vaccinated. So how do you close that gap?
It's a real challenge. I think what we're seeing now is a combination of several different forces. You have the fact that vaccines have become politicized in a way. So to the extent that you see really shocking discrepancies between the percent of Democrats and Republicans who either are or are willing to or planning on getting vaccinated. And that's a challenge that public health really hasn't confronted in past vaccine controversies. Traditionally, it has been surrounding other issues outside of politics. And because politics right now are so divisive, and it's so hard to communicate sort of across the aisle, I think that's going to be the hardest challenge moving forward. But then on top of that, you also have these sort of pockets of anti-vaccine activism or vaccine skepticism that have been brewing around the country for several decades now. And those communities, which have traditionally been focused on things like the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine or the DTaP vaccine, now have shifted their attention also to the COVID vaccine.
Well, just to be a little more accurate here, an NPR Marist poll in the spring revealed that up to 1/4 of the nation's population would decline to get a vaccine even when it was offered. And at this point, roughly 45% of the country's been vaccinated. And of course, the president admitted it yesterday, but the White House did, that they didn't reach their goal of 70%. I think there's about, they said 150 million have both shots, and about 175 in total have had some vaccine. So they're about 5 million short of the 180 million. And what would you attribute that to? How is the anti-vaccine movement in many ways responsible for that shortfall?
I think it's a couple of things. It's certainly anti-vaccine activism, but now anti-vaccine activism has sort of bled over into political activism. And so this is a pretty clear example of where you have a huge, just overwhelming amount of scientific evidence, not only obviously that the coronavirus is contagious and deadly, but also that the vaccine is overwhelmingly safe and effective. But that scientific reality is being put into question by both anti-vaccine activists and political leaders. We had a president, former President Trump, who was for months downplaying the severity of the virus, calling into question the leadership of the scientific community, obviously had a very strained relationship with Fauci. And so for that portion of the country that just doesn't believe anything that Democrats or Fauci says, it's that it's going to be a big challenge to get those people vaccinated if they are not predisposed to doing it anyway. And it's especially a challenge if people have not had a personal connection with someone who's been affected by COVID. So what you see even in more Republican communities or in communities with a large anti-vaccine population, when you have someone who knows a family member who was hospitalized or died, or someone who's been who's witnessed how horrible COVID infections can be, then you tend to see higher vaccination rates there. But getting over that last hump, and we would need to be even beyond 70% to get herd immunity, I think that's going to be a real challenge.
And again, I'm speaking with Seth Manoukian, who's director of MIT's graduate program in science writing. And his latest book is The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. But still, you'd think that, I mean, as much as Dr. Fauci's been attacked on the right, the fact that he's saying that 20% of the new cases are this Delta variant, that's 60% more transmissible than anything else. It's even evidence it indicates that you can get reinfected even if you had COVID from this virus, and that it's basically exploding, and it will become the dominant COVID strain in the nation in a matter of weeks. So again, we've had the evidence that in January, you had 3,000 people dying a day. Now it's about 300, but it's about to go back up again. So the vaccines, objectively, people should recognize that they're working. But now with this new threat, then the urgency is even greater, which is what the president indicated yesterday and what Fauci is saying today. So one of the stories that's out today
Seth, is that 153 Houston hospital workers have lost their jobs because they've refused to get vaccinated. And I find that extraordinary that nurses and hospital workers and even some doctors won't get vaccinated. How could that be the case when they see it? You just mentioned that people who've seen people die tend to realize the folly of their ways and get vaccinated. But boy, this is an amazing story.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing in Houston is obviously pretty frightening in terms of nurses opting not to get vaccinated. Texas is an area with a higher rate of vaccine skepticism than the rest of the country. It's a Republican-leaning state. But I think also it's important in situations like that to remember that the overwhelming percentage of healthcare workers are getting vaccinated. And so 153 nurses in Houston sounds like a lot. But when you look at the overall number of healthcare workers in the country and the incredibly high percentage of them that are getting vaccinated, sometimes I worry that when we highlight those stories, and obviously that's a story that needs to be told and is an important story, sometimes we don't also shine a light on the inverse, which is how many people are still getting vaccinated. But I think, one of the things you see there in Houston is just the extent to which kind of expertise has come under fire over the last several decades. If you go back half a century, being called a scientist or being an expert in something was not considered like a slur in some parts of the country. And expertise has been, and the notion of sort of objective truth has been called into doubt so consistently for political purposes that I'm not surprised that you see pockets of what you're seeing in Houston, even in populations in which you would assume know better. I think another thing that points to is that public health messaging in the country leading up to the coronavirus was not fantastic. And so now when there's a situation like this and we're trying to kind of inform the public about a number of different things, including herd immunity and susceptibility and transmissibility, that can be a real challenge when discourse around public health and discourse around science has been kind of not occurring at a very high level for a long time.
Well, one of the nurses at the Houston hospital who's suing the hospital, she's raised about $200,000 online, starting a nonprofit called Guardians of Medical Choice, and she's getting support from Alex Jones, the conspiracy theorist and huckster. But interesting enough, she's also getting support from liberal anti-vaccine activists and from libertarians as well. So it's across the board politically. I've always found it extraordinary, Seth, that scientists, this relates to the global warming controversy as well, that they get accused of making stuff up or being sort of reckless and too fast out of the gate, when the opposite is true. Scientists are incredibly conservative. They're rigorous in their, we had a case where there was a couple of scientists in Utah that said they'd found nuclear fusion, and they were shot down pretty quickly. But the truth of the matter is that they're very conservative and don't get ahead of themselves. And look at what happened with the J&J vaccination. The caution was such that, six cases of blood clotting after millions and millions of vaccinations. And yet that lesson seemed to have backfired, that actually helped anti-vaxxers. Rather than the evidence being how cautious J&J was, the anti-vaxxers seized on that as an example of how dangerous vaccinations are. So it's almost like you can't win with these people.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, I think it's not almost like you can't win. It is like you can't win. And I think that's true of conspiracies in general. When you have someone who is a really fervent believer in a conspiracy, it doesn't matter what evidence you show them, because evidence pointing to the fact that their conspiracy is actually not accurate tends to only reinforce their belief that it is, in a kind of paradoxical way. What is important to remember is that the number of people who are sort of the hardcore anti-vaccine activists is minuscule, even compared to the number of people who are choosing not to get vaccinated. Most people who are saying, I'm not going to get vaccinated, are not doing it because, you know, they've done what they think is their own independent research. They're doing it because they don't really know. Some friends on Facebook forwarded on an article that turned out to be fake, but they didn't realize that, about dangers or myths or something about vaccines. And they figure, you know, it seems like coronavirus is dropping, so I'm just not going to do this. I think what the public health community needs to do is to try and reach those people, because trying to reach the people who are sort of on the front lines, I think is essentially a lost cause. But the number of people who are on the front lines, if all of those people were not vaccinated, that would not be an issue in the country. That's a very small percentage.
Well, some of the anti-vaxxers, I mean, this woman, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, an osteopathic physician, there's a video that's been going around, which is laughable in the sense that she claims that, and she was testifying in a public health hearing in Cleveland, Ohio. On video, she's claiming that the COVID vaccines magnetize your body, and then she puts a hair clip against her forehead to see, and it falls to the ground, and then she picks it up again, and it falls to the ground, and eventually she holds a finger and holds it up to her forehead, claiming that it's sticking to her forehead because her body's magnetized, as opposed to the fact that her finger is holding it up. So, I mean, it's absurd, but I guess the last thing you should do is make fun of these people. But short of that, how do you reach them? Or do you think it's a lost cause?
Well, yes. Someone like her, I think, you know, someone who holds a piece of metal up to their skin multiple times, it clearly doesn't stick to them and still insists that they're magnetized, I think that is a lost cause. I think you're correct that making fun of them, as tempting as that is probably not the best tactic. But I've found oftentimes that, you know, you really can't address all of the insane theories and conspiracies and ideas. You end up just playing whack-a-mole. You know, so if you say, no, this doesn't magnetize your blood, and here's why. And then there's another equally crazy theory. Let's say, you know, the next day someone says vaccines are made out of alligator eggs, and if you get vaccinated, you're going to grow scales. And you say, well, I'm not going to even respond to that. That's so ridiculous. That doesn't need an answer. If you respond to something the day before, then people will say, well, are they not responding to this because this is true? So I think when it comes to those kind of crazy left field theories, the best thing to do is to kind of ignore them completely and instead emphasize why the vaccine is important and safe and effective. Another reason why I think that that's a better tactic is because there's now a very large body of research showing that when you say something, even if it's to refute that fact, a certain number of people will come away from that thinking that it's true. So, you know, if I came on and said, I just want to make an announcement that, if you get vaccinated, you will not turn into an airplane, you know, obviously absolutely insane thing to say. By introducing that idea, there will be a certain number of people who will come away from that thinking, oh, I guess getting vaccinated turns you into an airplane. So even repeating these outlandish claims, when public health officials do that in an effort to show why they're not accurate, I think can do some harm. And it really makes more sense just to emphasize, here's the research showing why it's safe. here are the number of people who were dying, and here are the number of people who now whose lives have been saved because of this, and focusing on those things.
But just in closing, back to Dr. Fauci's warning that 20% of the new cases are this new dominant strain, the Delta variant, and that it will become the dominant strain in the nation in a matter of weeks, and it's 60% more transmissible. There's evidence that people who've had COVID have been reinfected by this new strain. It's clearly serious, and we could have a very, very dark winter, and you've got what? Still a huge amount of people in the country not vaccinated, particularly in the South. The young are not being vaccinated. There are all kinds of incentives now, lotteries, you know, paying people to get vaccinated, etc. I can see the concern on the part of public health officials. How do you see the next few months unfolding? Because there was a sense that we'd have a really optimistic summer and fall with the country opening up, and they did at least have, you know, there was a rock concert at Madison Square Garden over the weekend with the Foo Fighters. So we're coming back. At the same time, it could get worse. So there's a very, very mixed signal out there.
Yeah, I think it's a lot is going to depend on the extent to which the vaccine protects people against the Delta variety. A lot is going to depend on, you know, what we see in terms of if there's a dramatic uptick in infections and hospitalizations and deaths. There is certainly across the country a huge, huge pent up desire to return to normal. And in some cases, my concern is that we're moving a little bit too quickly there. We've sort of gone from, you know, 0 to 60, where we had, a month ago, capacity at venues was limited to, in Massachusetts, where I am, was limited to 25%. And now they're at full capacity. We had masks required for everyone. Now it is not required. We're sort of on the honor system that if you haven't been vaccinated, you're supposed to wear a mask. And so, you know, it could go either way. I think the fact that it is summer is beneficial, because one thing that we have learned is that outdoor transmission is fairly rare. It's not impossible, but it's fairly rare. But, you know, when we see people going back into concert halls, thousands or tens of thousands of people in an enclosed space, we see people at sporting events where, you know, you not only have tens of thousands of people, but you have them shouting, which is a way to spread the virus. You know, it is going to be kind of both interesting and scary to see where this goes. I am the fact that, you know, there are states like Massachusetts that have reached their vaccination goal, and it seems like there are still more states that are heading in that direction. I'm hopeful that we will be able to avoid the types of things that are going on in Western Europe right now, but I think it's still very much an open question.
Well, Seth Manukyan, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Of course, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for dealing with this topic. It's an important one.
And again, I've been speaking with Seth Manukyan, who's director of MIT's graduate program in science writing, and his latest book is The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
disappear.